From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, a UWM conference will explore how to heal from trauma. We'll talk to one of the speakers. And on Capitol Notes, Republicans are crafting their vision for Wisconsin's state budget, but it needs approval from Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
They need to make their caucus happy, but also get something that Evers will sign. And the question is, have they put together something that the governor could live with, or are they risking him vetoing the entire thing?
Finally, for Pride, we'll learn about the documentary Wisconsin Pride, which dives into our state's LGBTQ history.
It's really about these figures who people have not learned of and feel they know now, and everyone sort of has their favorites and want to learn more, which is great.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. We'll start today with Capitol Notes.
This is Capitol Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, there was a big Joint Finance Committee meeting last week. That's the State Budget Review Committee. It's controlled by legislative Republicans, and the governor has already proposed his version. The state budget is pretty all-encompassing. It determines everything from aid to local governments, to funding for safety net health care, to infrastructure fixes around the state. What are the big takeaways at the moment from that hearing and where we're at with the budget?
Well, Republicans laid down their marker on taxes and education. Now, there's still, you know, some stuff to come from the committee, like on the University of Wisconsin system, but they passed a package for K-12 education, much smaller than what Evers proposed, and they did their tax plan. Now, remember, the governor had been in negotiations with Republicans for weeks, a couple months, really, and we were kind of waiting to see what came out of that. Those talks broke down. Now, Republicans are moving ahead, trying to craft a budget that they can get through their caucuses and on the governor's desk. It's going to be interesting to see how they put this thing together because their numbers are smaller than years past. They need to make their caucus happy, but also get something that Evers will sign. And the question is, with the tax cut package and the education plan, have they put together something that the governor could live with, or are they risking him vetoing the entire thing?
As you mentioned, Governor Tony Evers ultimately has the final say over it. He's got the partial veto power. He can veto words, letters, numbers, punctuation. At this point, do you think he'd sign off on the tax plan and the
K-12?
Question.
Now, so first off, K-12. So the governor, he proposed $3.3 billion in state aid to the Department of Public Instruction. Republican lawmakers passed $336 million. Obviously a big difference. One thing to keep in mind is that Governor Evers in the 2023-25 budget used his veto pen to extend by four centuries an annual increase in how much schools can spend per pupil of $325 each year. That's an increase every year. That cap applies to what districts spend between property taxes and state aid. Looking at the motion that Republicans approved, there's not a whole lot of state aid going to that formula for how much schools can spend. That would normally mean a property tax increase. Now, it's fascinating with Republicans. They have been obsessed about your property tax bill for years, especially under Scott Walker when he was governor. That was always a focus of having, you know, a kind of a small to no increase in property taxes. They're kind of looking at it this way. One, they could still come in and do other things in the budget that would impact what that property tax bill would look like. But two, they seem to be banking on the idea that if things stay as is and there are no other changes, that voters will blame Governor Evers for their property tax bill going up because Evers is the one who did that 400-year veto. He set that annual increase going forward. They seem to be saying, okay, this is going to be the governor's problem. So there's that one piece to it. Number two, the tax plan. The governor has vetoed a retirement income break before, expansion of the income covered by a tax bracket. He's done that before. Now, though, he's getting closer to a possible reelection bid. So would he veto this again with reelection in mind? You know, there's all kinds of dynamics to that. You know, the governor, He has said he won't announce or make a decision about a third term or running for a third term until after the budget is done. But you got to wonder, would this factor into his decision about what to do? Because, you know, people kind of like tax cuts sometimes. So it'd be interesting to see how he approaches this discussion with November of 26 looming in the background.
You've mentioned, obviously, K through 12 funding was a big conversation last week. Public schools get a per student funding from the state. That's depending on how many students they have, right? And it hasn't kept pace with inflation. So that's really led many school districts to go to referendum. And you've been talking about the property tax increases and that kind of thing. How likely is it that we'll see an increase in per student funding in this year's budget?
Well, right now, none. So remember, it's already baked in. Because the governor issued that veto in 2023, you have that automatic increase every year of $325 per student, what you can spend. Again, spend between property taxes and state aid. So that's going up. The question has kind of been, how much state aid Republicans put into that formula to hold down the property tax hit? Right now, they're not putting much in. And I don't want to diminish $336 million. That's more than I got in the bank, right? But in the grand scheme of the school funding fund for education, it's not a lot of money. So you're talking about, I think they quoted like $1 billion more overall for schools to spend, but two-thirds of that would come off your property tax bill. So it's kind of the approach to funding schools that they're looking at right now.
What I want you to lay out is how it all works, just a basic primer on the property taxes, referendum, and state aid, how those all work differently in terms of getting funding to schools.
So back in the 90s, the state implemented a system where districts were kind of locked in what they were spending per student, and it varies from district to district. They were locked in, but then the state committed to basically funding two-thirds of education. What they did, though, is say, okay, we're going to take what you're spending right now. We're going to kind of put that as their benchmark. Then we'll give you an increase each year, how much you spend between property taxes and state aid. And on average, the state will cover two-thirds of that cost. Now, over the years, we've had good and bad years in Wisconsin, right, for state revenues. So we've not always hit that two-thirds mark. And there are other things that have kind of been pulled away over the years. It used to be a three-legged stool. You had the revenue limits on how much you spend per student, called the qualified economic offer. It said to districts, if you offer teachers this much of an increase in salary and benefits, they can't go to arbitration. But that's locked in. And that kind of like kept salaries at a certain pace for a long time. So that's the background. Now, fast forward to Republican years under Scott Walker. They put state aid into the formula often. They didn't always give an increase in the spending per pupil on an annual basis. That meant that the state money put into the formula mostly drove down property taxes rather than increasing the overall spend. Now with this new setup we have with the Evers veto, you're getting an increase every year for now for four centuries, $325 per kid. The question becomes then how much state aid goes into the formula. Because again, the more state money you put into K-12, the less districts raise from taxes. If you don't put a lot more money in, they raise even more from property taxes. That's where we're at right now. With this motion that Republicans passed, you're going to see a big kind of hit for property taxpayers. Now, there's still time. There are other pieces of the property tax bill. You got counties, cities, tech colleges, right? You could also do other things that could impact that. So Republicans may have other property tax proposals to come. But as you sit here right now, most of the money that schools would get to spend, new money to spend, would come from property taxes, not from state aid for the 25-27 biennium.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Okay, another area of K-12 quizzical questions that I had for you this week is the special education reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So local schools have a mandate to provide services for students with special needs, but the funding they get from the state doesn't come close to covering the total cost of special education. It's been a really hot topic this year. What's the latest on that?
And that's interesting because Republicans chose to put most of that new money, new state money, into K-12, into the special education programs. So right now, if you're a district and you have special needs kids, you get reimbursed for your costs. You don't get reimbursed for everything. The rate's about just north of 32% right now. Governor Evers wanted to take that to 60% to get there. And that's the main pot, main program. To get there, it costs more than $1.1 billion. There's then a second program, high cost special education. These are kids that it's $30,000 in cost per kid in a year, you know, much more demands. Smaller pot of money, small number of kids. Now, we're also not reimbursing 100% of that. Republicans have gone above the current spending reimbursement rate. Actually, for the high cost program, they want to reimburse more than what Evers proposed. But that main program, the main special education pot, they're about 37, 38%, right in the middle there somewhere, of for reimbursement compared to the 60 that Evers wanted. The thing to keep in mind, though, is we have a lot of cash on hand in Wisconsin right now. The surplus is going to be $4.3 billion at the end of this fiscal year, June 30th. But that's one-time money. And a concern from Republicans is the more you spend or put into tax cuts, the more you're committing to future. It's called future commitment. So that means in the next budget, which I know is 2 years from now, 2027, hopefully we'll all still be here. If you use that one-time money to cut taxes or pay for ongoing programs, you create a hole in the next budget. You have to have revenue growth, tax increases, or spending cuts to make things balance, right? So let's say you take that $4 billion in surplus, put it all in education. Well, you're a lot likely to grow $4 billion in the next budget. So where do you find the money, right, to keep spending at that level? That's what I'm getting at. There's a challenge here that people think we got all this money to spend, which we do. But if you spend it for ongoing commitments, you create a problem for yourself long term. Republicans are trying to find a way to find a sweet spot for their caucuses where they put just enough into taxes to make some people happy. That's your $1.3 billion without creating so much of a commitment going forward that in 2027 we go, oh, man, we're in trouble. You know, we've got all these costs to go cover, and we don't have the money anymore.
Very interesting. It does seem like a conundrum. So Joint Finance is tomorrow taking up other topics, specifically corrections and the UW system funding. What can you preview for us about that?
Now, remember, Governor Evers was negotiating with Republican lawmakers for a couple months on the budget. The going thought was if the governor had been able to reach a deal with Republican lawmakers, then UW probably would have gotten something okay. I'm not saying $855 million like they asked for, but more than zero. Now those talks have broken off. There's a lot of speculation of, well, what's going to happen to UW? Because remember, Republican lawmakers are still pretty hot at UW over diversity, equity, and inclusion. They feel like the system is still too immersed in that. They don't like it. So the question becomes, will they get cut? And if they get cut, how much? I mean, if they ask for $855 million more, that's not going to happen. Could they actually get cut from current levels? With corrections, the big question is, how much of what Evers wanted to do to revamp the system were Republicans agree to? There seems to be a consensus that the prison in Green Bay should be closed. Dates back to the 1800s. It's locals want to get rid of it so they can open that land for development. It's not very safe or easy to manage. So a new facility would make sense to some people. The governor didn't include a new facility in his proposal. He wants to close Green Bay, rearrange a bunch of other stuff with the system, and reduce number of beds like around 700 or 900 beds that we have right now. Republicans want to close Green Bay. They don't want to reduce the number of beds we have in the prison system. They are talking more about building a new prison somewhere in Green Bay. Can they reach agreement on that? That's what I'm watching there is what's the system going to look like after? And, you know, will Evers agree to a new prison if Republicans go that route? Remember, Evers ran in 2018 promising to try and, like, address our prison population. We incarcerate more people than other states do on a per capita basis. There are some that argue there should be alternatives to imprisonment, new approaches to our system. Can they reach an agreement? Will the governor be happy with what they do to his plan when he signed into law?
All right. Well, thanks so much for the insights, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast, download, and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll hear about early LGBTQ figures in Wisconsin's history. They're featured in a documentary by PBS Wisconsin. But first, a conference tomorrow at UW-Milwaukee will explore the effects of trauma and how to heal. Stay tuned to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow, UW-Milwaukee's School of Continuing Education will host a conference on trauma and reimagining solutions for healing. One area of focus is intergenerational trauma and how Indigenous people are affected by colonization, loss of language and culture, and displacement. Marin Denning, an adjunct lecturer at UWM, will be one of the presenters. He'll explore how connecting to traditional Native American practices can help heal trauma. Ahead of tomorrow's conference, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
When we are talking about trauma in the Anishinaabe community and the Native community more generally, what are some of the sources of this trauma?
One of the most interesting aspects about trauma in our community is that it's everywhere. And it's so regular in its presence that we don't even know it's there. For a lot of our parents and grandparents, and of course the people before that, our boarding school generations, we can point to one of those as a source, where children were separated from parents either by force or by necessity. There were no parenting role models. And so when these children were going through boarding schools, they were exposed to a lot of things children shouldn't be exposed to. And that shaped their life. They didn't have parents interacting with themselves. They thought that what they were going through, things like sexual abuse, isolation, corporal punishment, that that was all normal. And that changed our entire society. There was like a cut between what we knew to be as parents into a new model of this is how we behave with each other. And when we enter those places, for a lot of our elders, for a lot of those folks who went through it, it's very much about, I'm going to be quiet about it. You don't talk about it. It's impolite. It's not places that we speak about. So it's hidden. And these sorts of patterns of behavior began to replicate themselves in our homes. And that pattern with silence meant that this trauma that was building or historic trauma would redouble. And of course, we now know that historic trauma can be passed down in the DNA of children. So not only are we being exposed to it as we're growing up without any words, but there's also an inheritance through DNA that this trauma becomes so normalized that we think it's a part of everyday life and that this is what it is to be normal, when in fact it wasn't.
Yeah. To take a step back, when we think about intergenerational trauma, how does that manifest itself in our Native communities? What does that look like today?
There are so many examples in our communities about what historic trauma looks like. And for me, and what became normalized for me, let's take, for example, the idea of young people and the loss of life. Let's look at our older people and the loss of life. Most recent example would be our pandemic. When we looked at that, we know that right here in Milwaukee, Native Americans were number two in transmission and number one in fatality. What that translates to is young people not just losing one grandparent or one aunt or one uncle, but a multitude of them. And for a young person going through these traumas over and over and over again in short periods of time, it affects their behavior, it affects their attitudes, it affects grades in school. Trauma affects how we see ourselves, how we interact with each other. It also affects, again, what we see as what's normal, when in fact we know it's abnormal behavior. It's not positive or building behavior that trauma can induce. It's evidenced in so many ways, and I would use myself as an example. I had three children. All of them left this world before me in ways that were traumatic for me. What was interesting in the beginning of that process after losing the first one, what would happen to me is I would be in stores and I would not be present. I would dissociate. I would put people at arm's length. I wouldn't engage in life. I slept on a floor, on a rug with nothing on the walls for almost 2 years. And to me, it's just kind of what you did. It's part of a healing process. It is, but there's other ways to go about it. Those ways were brought to me by other Indigenous people, especially our veterans who had been through post-traumatic stress and brought to me ways that they had learned from military or from other people to say, this is how you can get through what you've been through. Because it wasn't just the loss of our children. It was also going back generations. So for me, I could look at these patterns of trauma being passed down to my children. But our family is so like other Native families, the example. I had a teenage mom. My father was killed before I was born. In our own family, in the generation before her, we had a grandfather who was taken to a boarding school with his sister. His sister died at the boarding school. Where is she buried? Why didn't he come home after his boarding school experience until his mother died? Those are traumatic events for young people, and there's an inheritance that goes from one family to another, and even beyond that, because our Native folks that were on reservations, and certainly our families are still there, there can be places of great impoverishment of emotion. The spirit of loneliness is there because it's just, this is what it is to be who we are. But to be who we are is so much more, and there's so many amazing things that we need to embrace. And that kind of goes to that question of what happens when things happen like me losing our children.
One of the big parts of your work is inviting people to reconnect with their own history. How do you open up that conversation? How do you open up the idea of reconnecting with your Anishinaabe ancestors as a way of moving forward?
There's a lot of different pathways because trauma is and takes different forms. It takes it differently for every person that it affects. So the path of healing for someone will always be different. And it's usually not a straight path towards healing. I've done this thing and now I'm moving forward. So, for example, to reconnect with culture, to find ways of healing and to move through the things that have harmed us in our life, we can look at regaining our languages, which is a very large and amazing movement in Indian country right now. So people learning language, learning to understand the world differently than what it teaches us, individualism would be an example. when we learn about individualism as a social construct, meaning I'm responsible for myself, I alone am moving into my future, there's another point of view that says we're doing this together and we do things as a community. I'm never alone. I'm always surrounded by this great world, all of what nature is and what she does for us. I'm surrounded by relatives and people that love me. And no matter what I go through, I'm never alone. Even though I may feel that way, there's things that I can connect with. So language can take constructs of individuality and create something like action, movement, flow, learning our water ceremonies, learning about sweat lodges, learning about our songs, learning about smudging, for example, using medicines to help center us, using different avenues to connect with our minds, our bodies, and our spirits. There's a multitude of ways to do that, and each of us in our cultures have different ways to do it. For many of our people, part of the trauma and that vicious cycle of trauma is that in that boarding school experience, many of our tribal ways that can save us were taken away. And many of those experiences where it's been taken away was taken away to such a degree, a person is no longer connected to those ways. So they're trying to find a way to reconnect. And that's where institutions and individuals step forward, like our veterans did for me, and say, there's another way to live. And we're going to give you some ideas of how to do that. And a lot of times for many of us, it's experimenting. For some, it's they find value in singing. For some of us, it could be our tribal dances. For others, it could be finding it in reading and learning more about our culture and having that quiet time alone from everything else. It could be taking a walk in areas that you find peaceful and safe to center yourself and to regain from a moment of manic thoughts where self-harm and the idea of taking one's own life, completing suicide, is a part of your being. It becomes so hardwired in those areas of trauma that it takes work and time and practice and dedication to regain it. I know that when I was in my deepest despair, we had some of our elders come to me and they would say, you need to take what you have inside of you to the earth. She will understand you. The earth has a memory. The earth has her own language in her own way. And you need to connect with her and get back with her because it's from her that you've come. It might be that in a moment of my life, that could have been falling on deaf ears. But the moment that advice came to me and the things that I did to do those things in a very tribally specific way was helpful, life-changing, and life-saving for me.
It's interesting what you say about, you know, individualizing this a bit and really seeing what the person needs to move forward. When you think about your work and your talks, what are you hoping people take away from it?
The one thing that I want them to take away is that they're not alone. And that's easy to say, and we hear a lot of counselors and other people talk about, you know, that you're not alone, and we see these advertisements for it. But that is a really difficult message to propose and to get out there to people who see themselves as individuals, who buy into the idea that my future is up to me and only me. Essentially, what's being said there is I alone am responsible for my healing. And I've heard many counselors enter into that. And again, that works for some people. They grew up in an individualist culture. It's like they've heard that message. It's consistent with what they've heard. And they move towards it in a powerful way, and it's helpful. Yet other people, the message of individualism is, I am an individual and I am alone. And at the end of the day, there's no one else. When people are walking out of the room after they hear me talk, I want them to embrace this idea that we are in this together. No matter where we are from, no matter where we're born, no matter the destination, we're surrounded by love, we're surrounded by people that want good things for us. And that we position ourselves to be around people that know how to do this. We exist as a group, and we succeed and rise and fall as groups. Yes, there's individuals and what we accomplish within it, but that's a part of this larger collective story. And that is one of the more interesting teachings that I've received from one of my elders. And it was this: we have this force within our life, just like our teachings, and they're positive and they're helpful. Love and bravery and truth and honesty and humility and all wisdom, all of these amazing things. But the teaching was there's an opposite spirit to that. And just as there is an opposite spirit to the all of us doing well and being well together, there's that opposite spirit that lives with the destroyer, a force so powerful that it has us sometimes lose our own minds, our own balance. And the helper to that is a spirit of loneliness. And so there's a lot of people that when they hear me talk, they're in that very place where they can't see anything. Their mom or dad might be in the next room. Their best friend might be just a text away or a phone call away. But they're feeling so alone that nobody understands that the world has a different view of things and that their look at the world is something that is only theirs, and they see no path to the future. That can be a cannibalizing thing for us once we get that set in our minds. What we need to do is remember there are other ways. And when Native people move towards our ways and our traditions, they will see the us, they will see the ours, they will see the people that care. And those people that care aren't just human beings. They're this natural world that is around us. When we walk out, when we see a moon in its full and in its brightness, or when it's covered, but she's always there, always there. When we walk on the earth, do we listen to her sounds? Do we center ourselves and know that all around us are things that can help us? These were the kinds of things that were taken from us and through no fault of our own have been forgotten by many of our people. But that door and pathway for all of us to learn these things, not just Indigenous people, but other people that know that they're there for them to help them, is a doorway that many of us should go through. When we're so in a place where we're not open to much of anything, sometimes it's like reaching back to that ancestral voice that existed before these traumatic things happened.
Beautifully said. Well, Marin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Awesome. Thank you.
Marin Denning is an adjunct lecturer at UWM, and he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The Trauma in Our Community Conference is happening tomorrow at UWM's School of Continuing Education, both in person and online. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk going on, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll speak with a producer of the documentary Wisconsin Pride, which explores the state's LGBTQ history. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. PBS Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Historical Society collaborated on a documentary telling the stories of LGBTQ plus Wisconsinites throughout the decades. Did you know that Wisconsin was actually the first state to protect gay rights? Well, it's still an often overlooked part of our state's history. The documentary Wisconsin Pride highlights both everyday people and trailblazing activists. The film shows the battles for human rights that took place in Wisconsin long before these efforts got the national spotlight. To learn more about Wisconsin Pride, I'm joined by PBS Wisconsin senior producer Andy Soth. This documentary, Wisconsin Pride, gives some great insight into LGBTQ plus people, issues, and the fight for gay rights over centuries of Wisconsin history. And that's in large part thanks to the guidance of Richard Wagner, who said, Wisconsin has been a trailblazer in ways that very few people understand. And you dedicated this documentary to him. He passed away in 2021. So to start, I just would love to share more about his significance, not just for this project, but what he's contributed in his lifetime.
Sure. Well, I'm always happy to talk about Dick Wagner. He was a multi-talented person. He served the state as a civil servant. He served the Dane County as an elected official, and then throughout his life was kind of a collector of what we now might refer to as ephemera and papers of LGBTQ history. And then he spent his retirement happily using that material and further research to write on LGBTQ history, first in the pages of Our Lives magazine, which is a LGBTQ publication based in Madison. And then he kind of used that to sort of build the chapters that became his two books. So he really, you know, there are people who are archivists, there are people who are collectors, and there are historians, and Dick was really all three. And then also bringing to that like a special kind of political knowledge, a deep understanding of the politics of the state. And while it's not purely a political story, definitely I think that's a lens through which Dick viewed history and his work.
As you mentioned, this has a very large scope. It's categorized in two parts. The first part explores how diversity in sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression are a normal part of the human experience. So can you touch upon some of these stories that are highlighted? One in particular that I was really grateful to learn about was the story of Ralph Curwenio.
Absolutely. Ralph's story is just really, really fascinating. And it's just such a... It's a good example of how gender norms were policed in, you know, most of U.S. history. Essentially, Ralph was involved in a love triangle. Now, he had been born female, but presented as male sort of after leaving nursing school. He and his partner, Mamie White, had difficulty finding work as nurses in an environment where they were both women of color. And often a condition of employment from doctors would be, you know, performing sexual favors. So they decided, and this also may have been, you know, this may have been the true, I think it certainly became the true gender expression of Ralph, but they thought a man's wage would help support them better. So Ralph began presenting as male and had been in that, established that identity by the time of coming to Milwaukee. Worked as a doorman at the famous Plankton Hotel and later at a factory. But the relationship sort of started to sour, and Mamie learned that Ralph was seeing someone else and indeed was engaged to be married to that person, and showed up at the factory saying that she wanted a job and was told, "We don't hire women here," and said, "Well, you have one," and revealed the secret. And that led to Ralph's arrest and his being kind of forced, you know, into a dress to do a court appearance. And it became, you know, quite a spectacle. The headlines, you know, called him the girl man of Milwaukee. And it's interesting that it's, you know, characterized as headlines used like a masquerade. And it was, the coverage was all about this deception that, you know, that he'd been pulling off, when of course the irony is this was really expressing his authentic self and not at all, you know, meant to deceive.
Another interesting point the documentary touches upon when talking about Ralph and other gender nonconforming people in Wisconsin is the care you need to take when looking into histories that are over 100 years old, when the things that we can identify today didn't necessarily have words for what they were presenting as or how they wanted to live their life during their time. So what were you learning and trying to take care with when you were looking into some of these stories? And obviously, these people are no longer here to give their firsthand account.
Of course, of course. And it just, you know, it's just the first part of the documentary is subtitled Hidden Histories. And of course, that's the great challenge of telling this history, is because if not for his arrest, we wouldn't, you know, Ralph would be lost to history. And it's unfortunate that so much of the historical record is their intersections with the oppression that they faced through the police or this sort of sometimes mocking press coverage. But it's also true that, you know, for example, you know, now most trans people will refer to their dead name, and it's something that, you know, they would not want you to use, and we don't really know about Ralph if how he felt about that. And in fact, he went on stage later, to try to at least make some profit from this notoriety, where he would first show up as, you know, as presenting female, and then as Ralph, and traveled on a short vaudeville circuit. So at least he was able to sort of take advantage of the public's kind of misconception and fascination.
Another story that touches upon looking into people's stories after they've passed, whether it's newspaper clippings, secondhand accounts, you're trying to piece the things together. And one story in particular, one person, is George Pullman Pogue, a man of great achievements who history should not have forgotten, if not that it was recovered and explored a little more. Can you explain his contributions to Wisconsin and the world, honestly?
Yeah, absolutely. So Pogue was, a brilliant scholar, really well-rounded individual. He grew up in La Crosse. His family were sort of servants to one of the, I think, a lumber baron. So they grew up on an estate, which did give Pogue some access to privilege. And he was able to attend the University of Wisconsin. And there he became the first African-American member of the track team, where he excelled, particularly in the hurdles. And he received an invitation to compete at the 1904 St. Louis Olympics. And there he excelled as well, winning two bronze medals and becoming the first African-American to medal in the Olympics. Then he became a teacher, but then history sort of lost view of him, and his accomplishments were sort of, you know, in the distant past and somewhat forgotten about. Then there became an effort in La Crosse by a La Crosse historian, Bruce Mauser, who had actually done a lot of research on the interesting history of La Crosse's African-American community, to learn more about Pogue and what happened after these events. And part of that trail seemed to give the historian thoughts that Pogue may have been gay, reading between the lines. His leaving his teaching position in a St. Louis high school seemed to be a sort of bit murky and unclear. He moved to Chicago, where he was a member of the Chicago Athletic Club, which was known as sort of a gay social hangout. And he lived in the cabaret district and even actually performed cabaret, as another one of his skills was as a great singer. And had a civil service career in the post office. So Professor Mauser sort of saw those clues, but did not really feel, and this is the difficulty, is, you know, how can you, you know, what, how do you, unless you have this sort of absolute evidence, can you assert what someone's sexual orientation is? And some would say, oh, that's not important, who cares? But, you know, really, it is such a part of identity. And obviously, I think it affected Pogue's career choices and where he went in his life. So the interesting story is that, you know, Mauser had done this research, but didn't really feel comfortable like he could make that assertion until the event where Pogue Park was dedicated and members of Pogue's family came. And I don't think Mauser was comfortable. He wasn't sure how to maybe approach this or ask this question. But then out of the blue, the grandnephew said, well, you know, my uncle was gay, right? So it gave that confirmation that completed the story and gave Mauser, you know, the confidence that he could make that assertion and add that element, an important element, to telling Pogue's story.
Another important element is highlighted in the second part of this film, and that's all about how Wisconsinites challenged the harassment and injustices that LGBTQ plus people faced long before it was a national story, long before Stonewall. We had our own Black Knight brawl here about 7 or 8 years before Stonewall happened. But one big component of this organizing throughout the years was the role of LGBTQ plus radio and publishers in creating awareness and community. Can you touch upon that a little more and how it was an essential part of the movement?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Gay People's Union was founded in the early 70s. And one of the first things they did was get on the radio, the first regularly scheduled gay radio program. And fortunately, it's archived. So there are some interviews we use of other historical figures from Milwaukee that are just wonderful to have, because you hear these voices of these people, you know, who have since left the public scene. And GPU News was their publication, and it really developed a national reputation for following gay culture and gay politics.
As a producer and co-writer of this documentary, what were some of your favorite things to learn or come across when you're sifting through primary documents, photos, these audio archives, or other pieces of history?
Well, one thing is a thrill. I mean, yes, I'm a producer, and I like history, but I'm not an historian. I'm not an archivist. But I understand the appeal and the thrill. So I was thinking about when we were talking about Pogue, his effects are archived at the UW La Crosse Murphy Library. And one of the items there is as a member of the post office in the late 40s, he had to sign a loyalty oath. Basically, this was about sort of the communist witch hunts, which related to that Red Scare was, of course, the Lavender Scare, and where federal employees could be fired for being gay. And so there's this, you know, great sort of direct evidence of why a person like George Pogue would have to be closeted, because of his, you know, way of life, his means of support would be eliminated if he came out. So discoveries like that are exciting. Another thing that, you know, because of the project motivated the digitization that was ongoing, but we were able to help out of a lot of material, and some of this material at the Madison LGBTQ archive includes, you know, a case of VHS tapes from a public access show that probably haven't been looked at for a long time. So it was great. Like, I felt like I'm getting this first look at history. And one of these was a record, a very well-documented record of an ACT UP demonstration in Madison that was led by Dan Savage. So it was just sort of a fun moment to see this very young Dan Savage, who's of course become, you know, a very prominent, well-known national figure. So having those moments of discovery was just kind of a real thrill.
And you, in turn, are sharing many moments of discovery with audiences who are most likely seeing a lot of this or learning about certain figures for the first time. What has been your biggest takeaway about sharing perhaps once unknown or once buried or uncovered history? And how do you hope it impacts the audience members who see this?
I mean, I think it may in some ways change sort of the, you know, the conventional view of history of, like, you know, one of cause of effect and one of great, you know, great events, and less about sort of how individuals live their lives, because, you know, what was the consequence? What effect did they have on the world? You know, they were not great leaders and politicians and generals and so forth. But, you know, honestly, that is, of course, what is most relatable. So telling these human stories, you know, we tell this chronology that kind of works together to develop an LGBTQ history of the project. But it's just a series of stories of individuals. And very relatable individuals, gay or straight. I think you see and recognize the humanity in all these folks. Someone like Ralph, or someone like George Pogue, or the founders of GPU. So I think that's really the takeaway. Is it's really about these figures who people have not learned of and feel they know now, and everyone sort of has their favorites and want to learn more, which is great.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for your work on this documentary. It certainly adds a great deal to more resources and more context for people to learn about and be proud of in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you. And I have to just share credit with a whole great team, and really with PBS Wisconsin, for investing in this project.
Andy South is a senior producer with PBS Wisconsin, who produced and co-wrote the documentary Wisconsin Pride. I spoke with him in 2023, and you can watch the film at pbs.org. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect today, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, colleges and universities are bracing for a drop in international students. We learn what that could mean for schools in our region. And while the loss of the bar This Is It still looms large over Milwaukee, we'll learn about its history and the legacy that will remain. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.